morning to everybody. We'll just be starting about 7 minutes or so. We'll continue with Kohelis chapter 4. Last week, the last halacha, the last law of Maimonides in Shemitah and Yovel. That's in the Mishnah Torah. There's some interesting points there, and there's a little bit more that we'll cover that today. So a little bit of a tangent, but very interesting. Start momentarily. This is about 5 minutes. Starting just a bit early today. So if you're hearing this as a recording, unless we have some conversation before the class, there may be some gap of a few minutes of silence. So you may want to just fast forward on the recording. And again, this is what we'll be taking up today is chapter 13 in Shemitah and Yovel, Shemitah and Yovel, in the Mishnah Torah, chapter 13, law 13, the very last one. Okay, I see Naomi, you just logged on. If you're picking up the audio, if you hear the audio okay, just type audio okay at the bottom of your screen. This way I'll just talk to you verbally without typing. And Naomi, if you're getting the sound, just type audio okay at the bottom of your screen if you're picking up the sound okay. I'm going to send you some text messages too. If the sound is not so good, Naomi, so try to turn up your the audio, the control panels on your computer. Go to the control panels and look for the audio or the sound and try to turn up the sound. And turn up your speakers too. And Shaul from Israel, Okay, nice of you to join. And again, we'll start just in about 2 minutes or so. Just wait for friends to call in. If you could still hear Naomi, look at the last entry I just put on screen. And hopefully that'll maximize your sound. Shoal, how's the sound for you? How are you doing out there in Washington? We're having some audio problems for Naomi. Maybe Laura, you could tell me if you're picking up the audio okay? And if you have any suggestions how to amplify, maybe you could type it on screen, address it to Naomi, because Naomi is not hearing so well out there. We will put the class is being recorded, so if you can't hear it well the first time, you could listen to it a second time. Okay, Laura, thanks. So Naomi, if you can't hear it so well, maybe the recorded version would be better, so you can go to the audio page. It's like the 8th link down on the left-hand side of the Misora site. So we put all the classes that are recorded, we put it there afterwards. So maybe that'll provide better sound. Okay, Doug and Cal. There we go. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi.
How are you? Good, how are you today?
Doing okay, thanks. Josh is with us and someone else?
Jim?
Oh, Jim's here.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Josh, how are you?
Hey, how are you?
Okay, and we got the Naomi from India finally is online with us, although the audio she's having not so great. Hopefully she'll be able to hear us, so if you all want to give her a greeting. She's online right now, so she could hear you.
Good evening, or no, good morning. Let's see, no, good evening, Naomi.
Hi, Naomi.
Hopefully, Avram's with you as well.
Okay, Naomi, that was Doug.
Naomi.
And it's Jim and Josh on the other phone. Okay, Naomi's saying that the audio is better now. Good. And Laura's with us. Laura from Washington is with us. And I think she's saying it's I think midnight in India. I'm not sure what time she's got there. Okay. All right, so Doug, thanks to your efforts in the rest of the Noahides. So Naomi's got, she's online. I think Avram is with her too.
That's excellent.
All right, so how are we from last week's questions? Any follow-up? And is Cal and Francesca there?
Yep, I'm here.
How you doing, Cal?
I'm doing good.
Okay.
No questions left over from last week here.
Okay. We actually discussed yesterday, we went back into that, the law of Maimonides and the end of Shemitah and Yovel, the one we're discussing. And no surprise, there's a lot more to be discussed in there. I'll highlight some of the points. I'll read it again, though. And just to, because it seems to be this, I mean, it's amazing how he writes. It just is truly amazing. You know, everything he's writing, it's almost like, you know, reading the Torah. He's following the same style where there's just a tremendous amount, and the whole style is very, very, every word is has a purpose. So I'll read it again. This is the last law. So it's 13:13 in the laws, in his Mishnah Torah of Shemitah and Yovel. So he says, we'll read, let's read 13:12 first. Go back there. Okay. All right. Everybody still with me?
Yep.
Okay, good. All right. And if anybody has any problem on the line, I think you just hit the end, the return key. And that should bring you back sometimes as a you get logged off or as a broken connection. So if you ever have any problem online, you see that you get a disconnect. So we don't have it too often, but sometimes it happens. So just go back into the room, re-enter, or try just hitting the enter key. Okay. All right, so Rambam says as follows. He says, he's talking about the tribe of Levi again. And he says, why is it that the Levites, that tribe, were not merited to get a portion of the land of Israel or to enjoy any of the spoils of war with the rest of their brothers? Because they have been separated out to serve God and to teach his ways that are upright and his statutes that are righteous to the multitudes, as it says. You would teach the statutes to Jacob and the Torah to Israel. So that's a quote. Therefore, they were separated out from the way of the world, meaning they don't work. He qualifies it, so I'll let him qualify. He says, what does it mean to separated out from the ways of the world, that the Levites don't follow the regular normative activities? He says they do not fall into arrangement for war, meaning they are not part of battle like the rest of the Israelites, and they do not inherit land, and they do not merit anything to themselves through the work of their hands. I mean, they don't work, they're not involved in acquisition or building and so on, but they are the army of God. Interesting term. They are the army of God, as it says. God has blessed his army. And he, blessed be he, merits them. As it says, I am their portion and in their inheritance. So that's law 12. So they do not inherit, they do not enjoy any spoils of war, and they also do not work in order to gather. So all of what they have is through God's system, where he commands the Jews to give gifts to the Levites. Okay? So that's the first thing that Maimonides says, is that he says that the reason why Levi is separate is because they are really separated out for a function of teaching. So we didn't ask this last time, if you want to just keep track of the questions, Doug. By the way, I rearranged the store part of the Masorah site. So the three publications, including your work, are more readily accessible now. So I know we ran a sale on it a couple of years back, but since I just put another book, I thought it would be good just to put all the books on the same level. So if you want to refer people to buy your book, getting it straight so they can go right to the store link. All right?
Oh, great. Thank you.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. Really good book. You have another one coming around the corner, don't you? Another one that's almost done?
I do. I'm just trying to figure out the best way to publish it. It's virtually done. Just either got to approach an agent, a publisher, or go to self-publish, and I haven't quite sorted out which direction to go yet.
Okay. If you want, we'll just speak afterwards. I did that with the last one I just put out, so I could tell you what I did so far.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That'd be great.
Okay, so the first thing you see over here is that you see that there's no acquisition, there's no inheritance, there's no enjoying of the spoils of war. For Levi, like the rest of the tribes, and the reason why, the Rambam says, again, Mifnei, because they are separated out to serve God, to worship Him, to teach His ways. And it's interesting that the terms that he uses, he says, let's just see, let's remind ourselves of the question. What was the first question I had, Doug? The one I just told you to write down. I forgot it myself already. They're the army of God, and he merits them. So why can't they do both? I think is the first question. Why can't they be involved in acquisition and in the work, and also be involved in the temple, meaning teaching? They're the ones that the Jews come to try cases and so on and so forth. Let me just make sure everybody online is picking up. If Naomi and Laura and Shaul, if you're picking up the sound, okay, just let me know on screen. Just type a message on screen, you get it. So I saw that with the screen blanked out just for a second over there. Okay, so the first thing is, why is it that they can't do both? Second thing, it says the reason why that they cannot do both is because they are teaching God's ways. They're worshiping. The first thing it says is they're separated out to worship Him, the Shar So, to worship, to minister before God, and to teach His ways that are upright. Right, number two. And His statutes that are righteous to the multitudes. Okay, so those three reasons. All right, so we have to answer why those three. Okay. Now, Law 13 is what we concentrated on. And Maimonides says it's not only the tribe of Levi, but he says as follows, not the tribe of Levi alone, any person from anybody who comes into the world. Right? He doesn't say any Jew, he says any human being that comes and enters into the world, that his spirit moves him. He has a generosity of spirit. And he understands from his own thinking to separate himself to stand before God, to minister before God, and to worship Him, to know God. And he goes upright as God created him. A very interesting statement. He goes right, he goes upright, he lives properly and straight as God created him. What does that mean? And he removes from his neck the yoke of calculations, of all other considerations of the masses. He removes from his neck, meaning he abandons the type of lifestyle which most other people are following, of making all sorts of calculations monetarily, and getting over-involved in investments and over-involved in business, and all other calculations. All other considerations about how he could get fame for himself. So what he does is he removes all that from his neck. Another interesting term. What does it mean? He removes from his neck. Just say that he's not involved in this. But he removes this from him, which are sought out the rest of mankind. So when the person does this, he now becomes Kodesh Kodeshim, meaning he's sanctified as the Holy of Holies. Again, that term is usually reserved only for the smaller room in the temple that houses the gold ark with the Ten Commandments and the Torah. So that's called the Holy of Holies. But now Maimonides here refers to this person. He has now sanctified himself as a Holy of Holies. Interesting. And God will be his portion and his inheritance forever and for all time. So then he's referring to this world and next world. Because forever and all time is it's redundant if you're talking about the same time and place. So it must be forever, meaning here Ulaome Olmem, for all eternity, God will be his portion. And then he will merit in this world, meaning God will now make sure, through God's providence, he will make sure that he has sustenance and food and clothing and shelter where it is sufficient for him. Just like God merits the priests and the Levites. Behold, King David, upon him be peace, said, God is my portion and my cup. You have perfected my lot. You are my perfect lot. Okay. So, we see that this is a statement about providence. And this is Maimonides' teaching, that it's this whole situation, this whole institution of the Levites is not reserved only for them. It's for any human being that enters the world, that his heart moves him or her to separate himself. And it's interesting how he uses the term separate. Also, when he talks about the Levites in law number 12, he says that. And he separates himself out to stand before God, to minister before him, to worship him. Again, we said also the real worship, as Rabbi Chaid explained, real worship of God is worship of the self, because you're not doing anything for God. So when you're serving God, you're really doing the best thing for yourself. You're bringing yourself in line with truth and what the purpose is in your existence. So, and also we noted yesterday, we were discussing this in Shul, in Temple, we noticed that the Levites have the obligation to teach. But if you look at Law 13, when he's talking about an individual, there is no obligation to teach. It's just to do for the selves. Even if he's not involved in teaching, he is still merits a portion from God. But what exactly is it that he must do? To know God and to go upright as God created him. So let's understand what these different terms are again. What is it that merits a person to this type of lifestyle? That he separates himself out, number one, to stand before God. What is he separating himself from? And then he says that he worships him and he seeks out to know God. Why is that the quality that's necessary for this? Let's say a person just does all the commands. He's following everything, every command he's following. Does that make him meritorious to this? It doesn't seem that way. It seems that he has to be worshiping God and he has to be involved in a search to know God. Not only that, he also has to walk upright as God created him. Walking upright now means that he's placing into action the morality, the ideals, the truths, and he applies it. So it's not just theoretical knowledge. It's something which he lives by. And on that, he says, he does this, he walks upright, and he lives that way as God had created him. Well, that seems to be very, it's an odd statement. I never saw this before. And also it says that he breaks off from his neck the yoke of the calculations of the masses that all other people seek out. And then it says also the same about he's made holy of holies. All right, so we've enough questions, I think, for a few sessions. But let me just stop here and see if you have any questions or some clarification or any ideas.
Well, one idea, Rabbi, that crossed my mind is the part you were talking about getting close to God. Knowing God,
right?
That wouldn't that be, you mentioned somebody who just keeps the commandment? Wouldn't the knowing God be a commitment to seeking out truth and reality and everything?
Again, I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, it's not a question. I'm offering a possible answer or interpretation of that one part.
Okay.
I don't have the text in front of me, but. That the seeking after God, in answer to your question, why isn't keeping the commandments enough? But why is there that extra part about, I think you said it's a seeking God?
Yes.
So would that be
search for truth, apart from the strict keeping of the commandments.
Right, exactly.
In other words, like philosophically, you're also committed.
Right, so you're saying that keeping the commandments does not necessarily mean that you're trying to study God.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's more than that. Maimonides is telling over here that this person is not simply following the laws, but to become what he calls Kodesh Kedushin, to become the sanctified, that means that he is living the perfect life, the optimal life. That's what he means when he says that he's Kodesh Kedushin, that he's brought himself to the highest level, like a Moses. So it's not simply that you follow what you're commanded. That means you're responding. A person who follows commands means he's responsive to what he's being. It's obligatory. It's like we have a split between fear of God and love of God. So that's what I think what we're grappling with over here, is that a person that merely responds to the commands, he's doing that. You could say he's doing that with fear of God. He understands that he has to do his obligation, or he may even say that he likes the system. You know, he enjoys the system. But if he is lacking in his pursuit of knowledge of God, then he's not really following the real plan. I mean, the real plan, you see that there were very, very few commands given to Adam and to Noah and to Abraham. What they were primarily involved in was in study, and they set up schools, and the yeshiva of Shem and Aver. Shem was the son of Noah, and they set up an academy to study God, because they realized that this is really optimum. And we've mentioned it, I think, a few times, that the greatest command in the Torah is study, more than anything else, more than charity, more than saving a life. Doesn't mean that if somebody's dying, of course you stop to save the life, but that's not the optimum. Saving a life has to have an objective. You live for a reason. So that's when we say that the greatest command is Torah study, that means to say that is the whole objective of a person's existence. So if the person is not seeking out knowledge of God and trying to learn more about the Creator and his will for mankind and truths about the Creator, so then he's not really living the optimal life. So that's why Maimonides says if this person does that, then he is. Okay. Now we asked also in the beginning, why, now is that point clear?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. And if anybody who's online has questions, just type it in and I'm looking at the screen so I can see what your questions are. Okay. Now we asked at the beginning, why?
Very good, Rabbi. Thank you.
Okay, sure. Yep. Now, why can't it be that, you see that in the first law that we read, Law 12, he says the Levites, they are not involved in any type of acquisition by their own might. They do not enjoy the spoils of war when they split amongst all the other tribes, and they don't get any inheritance of land. Why is that part of this whole picture?
Yeah, but I think it's because they were the only ones that stood firm with Moshe and with Hashem.
Well, let me ask the question again. The question is, why is it that their role cannot, their role as teachers, giving responses to the questions of people, why can't that role tolerate them being involved in some sort of labor? I mean, it talks in the Talmud about the sages, the Talmudic rabbis, some were water drawers, some chop wood, they all had professions. So why is Levi...
They had to be the teachers.
Rabbi?
Yes.
I think it's even more than that. It's to sort of show that they are to be seen as teachers and not just like everybody else.
Why can't they be seen as teachers if they have some sort of a job?
Well, they are seen as teachers, but if they were engaged in the livelihoods of everyone else as far as making a living then it would, the fact that they're teachers makes a statement of how important what they're teaching is, that they're so involved in it. And if they're involved in the things that everyone else was involved in, then they would be seen as being more just like them and not put at that level of how important the teaching is.
Okay. I agree with the path that you're on, but you still have to answer a little more, because the Talmudic rabbis that were teachers, they had jobs.
Can I offer a possibility that if they're not, the law indicates they're not involved in three things: acquisition by their own might, involvement in war, and inheritance of land. Every one of those things is a distraction from learning, because it requires them to focus their attention on the acquisitions or the fighting or tilling the land or whatever, and they were set aside to be totally focused on learning and teaching and not have to deal with the other distractions of life that the rest of the world has to deal with.
Okay, so you're saying in order to have the optimal situation of a teacher, that's the optimal state where there is no distraction.
That's the optimal state, right?
Right. So they were commanded by God to do this. The rabbis and the Talmud were not, so they had to eat, and they weren't getting gifts because they weren't Levites, so therefore they had to work. So it's just a practical thing. So, of course, you'd say the same thing. It'd be optimal for any human being if they could be totally focused.
And also, Rabbi, isn't it so that they should keep their purity?
No, there's nothing impure. There's nothing impure about working.
They're not allowed to be with the dead, unless it's family, quote, immediate family, or even a sister who hasn't been married yet.
What does that have to do with, I mean, the dead is not the issue. The issue here is about working. Well, we're only talking about...
I'm just saying that it has to do with keeping... Working is, as Doug said, something about keeping them from being distracted. That they should use their entire time to be available to the people and to learn and to teach.
Right, I understand that.
But I don't know.
Well, yeah, that's what Doug is saying. It's not a purity issue, I'm saying. Right. Is that a matter of
purity?
It's not a matter of
further purity. Keeps them from being involved in things that would be distracting.
But that's not a purity issue. Burying the dead would be a purity issue.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. Going to visit anything involved with the dead is would take away from the purity.
I know, but we're not addressing purity. We're addressing only work. Why is work something which is prohibited for them?
I'm just adding that. That's another reason. In other words, it's to explain that they should keep themselves pure and also not distracted. From work is distracting, visiting the dead, in all the categories. There's all different categories that they're limited to. They're not, and also the other people are supposed to help them with food, and they're supposed. I'm really not clear. I don't have it in front of me, but I remember reading it somewhere that they were designated to be on top because they stood by Moses and Hashem.
Okay, there's different issues that you're bringing in that aren't really, those are all true things you're saying, but they're not really pertinent to this. It's true that they stood by and they didn't serve the golden calf, and it's true that they're not allowed to be, you know, involved in the dead, but we're only focusing on one question, and that question is, what is the issue of work? And it's not, you know, we have to be clear, and we have to be in a very exact, you know, when we learn. So there may be a lot of other things that are true regarding a Levi, which you're bringing in that are right, but that's not the point about the work issue. And purity is not, I don't think we should overlap and say that because they're also restricted from being contacted in the dead, that maybe there's something that may have a different idea altogether.
Okay.
And so we're trying to focus in on what is it about not getting inheritance, not ensuring the spoils of war, not actually doing any work with their own hands. And what Doug is saying is that's an issue in terms of distraction. The optimum would really be the person who's just learning full time. And I guess Doug would have to agree also that if any person can, it's better off that they're completely focused on study. So, and that would definitely give them a higher level, which has to be true, because the Levites are not any different of design than any other human being.
Right.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
So a question on that, because if they're totally involved in study, doesn't, I want to say it's Ethics of the Fathers or the Talmud say that study without work, there's a negative consequence to that, and work without study, and that the ideal life is to have both?
Right, unless there's a command. It could be that the work aspect, like I was reading the Duties of the Heart, and let me just answer Naomi one thing. Naomi, you're asking how to speak. I'm assuming you mean verbally. Doug and all the other people who are on the phone, there's a phone number to call in. So I guess you can call from India. Is there a number I should give her, Doug? It seems to be from online that Naomi's asking that she wants to know how to speak, not just type.
Why don't I correspond with her about that on email? The number changes sometimes, and I don't know if she's got unlimited long distance. We can certainly set that up and give her the number here. I'm not sure that it wouldn't be prohibitively expensive.
Right. Okay, so Naomi, Doug is going to email you.
Yeah, okay. Cal will put Naomi on the list that will include the phone numbers and go from there.
Okay, very good.
So she'll get it every week.
All right, she just typed thank you on screen.
Okay,
Naomi. Yeah, so it is true. I was thinking about that as well, that Duties at Heart says the reason why it's necessary for man to work are two reasons. One is that if he was not working, he would be involved in sin. That means that the energy of a typical person can't be satisfied completely through Torah study. There has to be some sort of a labor, some sort of a physical exertion in order that the person's energies are being used properly, and then there's no other energy left to go into sin. The second reason he gives is why work is essential, is that it allows a person to demonstrate his values. So when he has to intermingle with people in society to procure his needs, how does he deal with people? How does he speak to them? How does he deal monetarily? All these different interactions with the other human beings allows a person to express the perfections that he has learned in terms of dealing with people. All right, so it could be though, but why do the Levites have they're not involved in any type of work? So I think this comes back to answer the original question, and that is that there is a higher level that a person can function on, and where God is, for example, the Jews in the desert for 40 years, they didn't work. That was a whole nation. God fed them with the man, and their clothing grew with them, and their shoes didn't wear out. Then they had their water taken care of, so there was no need to be involved in pursuing any type of needs. They had everything. So, and the rabbis referred to that generation as a knowledgeable nation. So they were involved in study, and they received the Torah. So those 40 years, they were immersed in Torah and in thought. So you see that a person can live on that level. And perhaps that's also why, what is the perfection there? Why is it that God created this institution where he wanted there to be this group that was not involved? So one thing, like you were saying, Doug, is that these areas of work and enjoying the spoils of war and inheritance, they can be distractions. But another idea, I think, that's true
is that it shows how God can provide, even if you're not working. Meaning it can be completely dependent upon God, just like the generation of the desert was 40 years. So the Levites are really to portray a level where if the person is pursuing God on such a high plane, so then God will override natural law and make sure that your physical needs are taken care of. That's why Maimonides said it's not only the Levites. He says any person that enters the world and dedicates himself to learn and to discover God, not just to do the commands, but that he's looking to learn more about God. And he applies it to himself so he lives virtuously, uprightly. He's honest and he follows the laws in practice. So then this person, and he says also interesting, he does this as God created him. Now he said at the beginning also that this person separates himself out from others. Why does he say that he separates himself? I mean, a lot of times you can describe something. Like, for example, I want to describe the color black. I can describe it in and of itself. Or I can describe it in a relative sense. Compared to red, black is X, whatever it is. So I can give a description which is relative. Like I can say, I am shorter than somebody else. Or I could say that I just have a certain height. I'm 5'9". I'm 5'10". I can give a description without a relative description. Here, Maimonides is saying that a person who devotes himself, he talks about him relativistically. He talks about him as that he separates himself from others. Why? See, I believe he's doing this for a very important reason. And I think that's the underlying theme here, is that a person typically is led to follow and make certain conclusions and sets a path for himself in life many times and in many ways due to the need for social approval, due to a underlying feeling that the masses must be right. But Maimonides is saying over here that the real perfected individual, human being, is one who lives independently. And therefore he can separate himself from others. He does not have that as a consideration. His thoughts are not clouded by the positions of others, whether it's reputation, whether it's how many people follow them, whether, what type of appellation the person has, the title that they have. No, this person Maimonides is talking about is one who does not have those considerations. His only consideration, is it true? Is this really what God taught? So that's what it means, is that he separates himself. The separation is that his thinking is pure. There's nothing tainting his thought. He doesn't worry about impressing others. And that's why he also says the words that he walks upright as God created him. What does he mean, he walks upright as God created him? You tell me, what do you think that means?
Rabbi?
Yes.
I think it means like all the other animals don't walk upright, and man is the only one that does. And so it's a separation to remind us that we're not to be living at the level of the animals or like an animal.
No, I don't think the animals is what he's referring to over here. When he says that he's walking upright, like he created him, as opposed to what? Not opposed to animals, as opposed to something else. And his words, you have to look at his words. Again, he says he goes upright, he walks upright, as God had created him.
Rabbi, I think he means with integrity and dignity.
Well, that's uprightness. What does it mean, as he created him? We're asking, in other words, what does it mean, as he created him? What you're explaining is that he walks upright, meaning with integrity and dignity, correct? But what's the additional words, as God created him? What is that coming to teach?
Because God created him purely. It's only we, mankind, changes things. we're born innocent. We're born pure.
Exactly. Exactly. That's right.
Okay.
Meaning that he's trying. That's very good.
We create our own. In a sense, we create. I wouldn't say our destiny, but it is true in a sense. What we do today affects what will happen tomorrow.
No, but your first point. Let's take your first point. When you said that, as what we do is we obscure later on. We dilute our purity. What does that mean? It means that when God created us, so at our beginning, there are certain things that are integral. For example, we have the instincts, we have the intellect, and certain things aren't really well developed, but there are things at the beginning of our creation, but they have to all be good. Because if God instilled in us the sexual drive, the appetitive drive, the ego, all these things have to be good, they have to be used a certain way. But there's something that he did not instill in us, something that was not as he created us. And what is that? Social approval. And if you look at children, you'll see that this point is true, that they don't really care about it. Somebody takes their toy, they grab it back. And even if it's not theirs, they'll go over and steal some other kid's toy because they are not functioning yet with this type of a social approval, this need for the acceptance. What they're purely interested in are the instincts, and that is what God wants. But I think what Maimonides is pointing to over here is that there's something which God didn't create in a person, and that is something which is learned by the society that he's in, and that is all these social needs that people have. So this person can separate himself because he has returned and he's brought himself back to the state as God created him. What's that state? Where he's only following the basic drives and paths that God wanted man to have and that God gave man at the outset. It's very interesting that there are certain things that we accumulate in our mind, the noise, as a friend of mine put it. We get full of noise. But to be clear on what I'm saying is that, for example, this need, this social approval, that's learnt. That's not something which is implanted in the person. And you see that it all depends on the society that you're in, what a person does in order to get the applause of others. So that's why I believe he's saying that over here, because he's trying to focus in with those two statements. One statement is that he separates himself. The really righteous person, he separates himself. He is not clouded by any other consideration except for truth. And that's why he lives upright as God created him, without the accumulation of false notions and false ideas and principles that the person feels that he has to now follow these niceties of society and all these social issues that people adopt later on. No, he doesn't do that. And if he did do that, then he'd be like everybody else. That's why he says a third statement. And he removes from his neck the calculations of others that other people seek out. Again, he's talking in a relativistic description. He's talking about this person who's righteous, who's completely perfected. He's talking about him, describing him in a relative way, because he wants to show you that is the whole issue over here. He's been able to extricate himself from the path that other people have mapped out for themselves, which is all about calculations and different considerations. No, he abandons all that. That's not his pursuit. His pursuit is purely knowledge of God and truth. So that's why there's three different references in this one law to how he is relative to others. All right, do you see all that?
Yes.
And that...
when he talks about the calculations, is he talking about, like financial calculations, or is he talking more... And maybe like the social thing you were talking about.
Well, a friend of mine said yesterday, a friend Max said that this was a quote. There's actually a footnote. I'm not sure if this is it, but what we're doing in Koheles, I think it's 729. If you want to turn to it, it has that term, the cheshbonos harabim, the calculations of the many. And that's what Maimonides says here. He quotes those two words exactly as they are in Kohelet 7:29. So what do they say the calculations of the many are? He talks about the lust and thoughts of sin. And he says this has been allegorized in the Medrash. This has been referred to in the Medrash. That's Rashi. Let's see if we have another. Yeah, Targum. The Targum says a very interesting thing. It has a very long explanation of that. And he says, and again, just the verse that this is going on is let's see. Yeah, the verse in 7:29, I'll read it to you, it says, aside, I have seen this, that I have found that God has made man upright. All right, again, he used the word yashar. And he's quoting this verse. He says that he follows God, kamo she'asahu ha'elokim. He lives upright like God made him. This verse says that. King Solomon says right here that God made man upright. But they seek out many calculations. So it seems to be clear that Maimonides is referring to this verse. He's talking about the procedural corruption that man goes through. I mean, he's made upright. But as he lives, he adopts a corrupt type of notions, and he starts living that way. So according to Rashi, that's talking about sin. According to the Targum, so the Targum says as follows. So he says like this, very interesting. He says that aside, I've also seen that God made Adam the first righteous, upright before him, and he was righteous. And he and his wife Eve, they deviated, and they ate from the fruit of the tree. That when you eat from that fruit, you become wise, and you know between good and evil. You start to learn about morality. See, they didn't have a knowledge of morality, and Maimonides in his God for Perplexed, the second chapter, he talks about this. Originally, Adam and Eve had no sense of morality. That's why they were naked, and there was no embarrassment. Because their area of study was the area of true and false. That was the area that's the highest area of knowledge. Because it is sin, as Rabbi Chait explained, so therefore God gave them it was very quick for them to sin. It was the same day that they were created. So what God did, he did an act of mercy, and he created morality. Morality causes a person to stop and think and feel guilty about something maybe he's about to do. And that was why afterwards they felt bad about being naked, to just show you that that was a change that God made in them. But that change was for man's own survival. Because if he didn't have that secondary brake system before he would sin, so then he would just destroy himself. So God gave man the opportunity to live in the best way. But when he violated that, so therefore he gave him another condition that would slow down the energies from getting involved in sin. He'd feel guilty and remorseful. So that's what he did. So that was the knowledge that they gained after eating. And he says, and of course the Targum goes on in this explanation, and he says that this caused them that the day that death would now overtake them, meaning normally Adam and Eve were going to live forever, but now they were going to be subject to death at a certain point. Not that they would die at that moment, which we see they didn't. He lived for almost 1,000 years after that day, but now death was now part of the makeup. All right, and then they sought after many considerations, many different notions in their life.
All right. That's another explanation of what it means that they, God made man upright, but then they saw it many calculations. So he's referring to after the sin. Let's see, Sforno. Let's see if he says anything on this. So he says that God made man upright, but then they had made many calculations. And he says to find out calculations and thoughts, many of them, that occur in man's search for food and clothing. And he says that he quotes the rabbis that many, many troubles did man have to go through until he could eat bread. I think though in the simple level is that man is distorted in his thinking and all of his different his emotions corrupt his thinking and things that he wants and false assumptions completely distort his path. A lot of this has to do with others though. I think it was Max who also pointed out yesterday that you see that God made man singular. He made him upright. I'm just reading the verse again. But they, plural, bhikshu, again, they sought out in a plural form many calculations. And one of the commentaries said that because they became a society and there wasn't one individual, so that's societal, and that's backing up what we're saying. The fact that there are others around causes a person to distort his thinking and have considerations of, that are all based in the social. Okay. But I think that's an important idea. It's an important idea that it's something which man did afterwards. After there were others around. And of course, that's our society, but that's what it means. And I believe also why Maimonides says a fourth statement, this person is now holy of holies. Meaning, he's again talking about, the word holy really means sanctified, means separated. That's really what the word kodosh means, that he's separate. So you see a fourth term in this single law that is talking about a person that separates himself. And he says God is his lot. So why is he saying that now? As opposed to his lot being with man, or his lot being with natural law. Not that the person is relying on miracles, but he realizes that God can offer a greater assistance, and he will do this, and that's why God gives this person merits in this life to have a sustenance. He has all his basic needs. But in order to get that, Maimonides says, you have to be a person that you're not just following the laws, but you are searching out to know God. Meaning that is the highest level of learning, is when you want to have the answers. You want to understand what God is. You don't want to miss this one opportunity in life. And, you know, again, the greatest mitzvah is a study of the Torah and God's will. But you see, he talks about so many times that he separates himself from others, and he walks upright like God made him, and he stands before God, and he doesn't do things that the other people do. He removes from his neck the calculations, all these different thoughts that other people seek out. All other considerations, whether it's fame or fortune or wealth or whatever it is, these are not the considerations for this upright person. So if he's living this way, Maimonides says that there's a guarantee from the Torah. And again, it's any human being, man or woman, Jew or Gentile. He doesn't qualify. Anybody who enters earth, this, he says, this applies to. And getting back to a question about the Levites, they're really, it's true that you're saying, Doug, that there's a distraction element. But I think it's also to demonstrate that they have nothing, they have no claim to land, to any of the spoils of war, any type of working they have no claim to. Demonstrating that they living the right life, God can be all they need. That's the lesson, that a person should have this trust. We talked about this, I think, a few weeks ago. That at the same time that the person has, he's doing what he can, and he has to work. And we don't, and again, my mind doesn't say over here that the person stops working. He still exerts his effort. But God now makes sure that he gets a response. A person could plant, and then he can have a devastation from nature. Or a person can plant, and he's living properly, and God will make sure that it brings him what he needs. The Torah also says that, you know, we have the law of, you know, Shemitah. I mean, that's very good why he places this law in the laws of Shemitah. You know what Shemitah is? Shemitah is referring to that every seventh year in the land of Israel, we are not allowed to work the land. Anybody who owns land cannot plant or reap or harvest. They cannot treat the land as their own anymore. They let it lie as it is. So the Torah says, well, a person will, I think it's even the verses in the Torah that say this, that you say, well, what are we going to eat if we don't plant? So God says, I will command my blessing on the land. If you follow my Torah, I will command a blessing on the land. What's the blessing? That the sixth year, the last year that you work the land before you remove your agricultural activities, God says, I will command that second year to last. It'll produce a threefold quantity of the previous years. It'll last for, it'll give you what you need for the sixth year. It'll give you what you need for the seventh year when you're not working the land. And it'll give you what you need the eighth year as you go back to work and start planting until the ninth year when you finally can harvest. So this whole concept of Shemitah, of letting, of every 7 years we must do this. Why is this part of the Torah system? You tell me.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Hello? Yeah, Rabbi, I think Hashem wants us to know that we should trust him and that he'll come through for us. But we have to put it to the test. A lot of people say, you know, if I don't work on Shabbos, how will I support myself? How will I have money? And it's on Friday as well, we're told that we should plant, we should buy food on Friday. And we will have enough, if we plan for Shabbos, we'll have enough for Shabbos. When Hashem gave us the man, he told the people, go out and collect twice the amount you could have for today and tomorrow, because tomorrow is the Sabbath to the Lord. So it's similar to that. It's the trust. We have to put our trust. If we don't have the trust, then we'll never know that it's really true, that it really works.
Okay, so why do we need to have that trust?
Sensing that.
So let's take it to the next step. Why do we need to have the trust? Why is it essential to the Torah system that we have this built in, this whole laws of Shemitah? You're saying what it is, which is correct. My question is, then, what is
why that? Why should we have trust? Because if we look around and we see everything else that Hashem has done, we have to have trust. We see everything that he has done already that's proof positive. That if he tells us something, he'll do it. He'll tell us something again. We should do it. It'll come to fruition.
Why is it necessary?
We trust. If we just look and see, then we could learn from it that we should trust.
Why is it necessary?
I think there's so many lessons to learn.
Why is it necessary? That's my question. You're again saying that we need to have the trust. I'm asking, why is that necessary?
Otherwise, we won't do it. We'll think that we're the ones, we're the commander of our ship, so to speak, that we're doing everything. We're not doing anything. It's only by the grace of God that we have anything.
Okay, good. Exactly. Meaning, I'll just say it like this, that if a person does not have the law of Shemitah, and they constantly work the laws of nature their whole life, nature, meaning a person can be led astray. I mean, you know how many scientists there are atheists? It's because there is nature, because there is a system out there, that now can be a very big misleading factor, and the person just learns to trust laws, and he looks at those things as being the reality, And that's why a person has a hard time even giving charity, because he gets so used to understanding how the laws of mathematics and science work, and they repeat every single day from his youth, that he's so conditioned that the concept that God is intervening and that God will respond and that he's really running all this can be lost from a person. It's a big danger. At the same time that God wants there to be a system of nature, we can't, there's this double-edged sword, that a person can be lost in nature and that's it. It's just, you know, there is no God. A person can get to that point because he sees a consistently functioning set of laws in the universe. So now these things are basically all that he sees. But he has to have that cognizance. So once every 7 years, there's a demonstration that he understands that there's a God that's behind us. And he will relate to me if I follow his laws. I mean, the Torah is something that he gave. It brings me back to following him and not nature. So that's what's important about it. Because there's this danger. And a lot of people fall into that pattern of life. The more I work, the more I'll have. I can't take off time to learn. I can't do that. And they aren't looking at the fact that that God is really running the system. They don't have the ability to minimize their work and to maximize the learning, which is a statement from Pirkei Avos. Ethics of the Father says, minimize your work and maximize your learning. Ma'at ba'osik ba'osik b'torah. But a person that will be able to do that is one who has the conviction in God as being the one that's running the universe. And that's the type of person that has no fears, and he's confident that if he lives right, then he'll be successful. It's the person who doesn't have that conviction in God that can't remove his hands from his labor and can't ease up and trust. So you see that's a very big theme. It's a huge theme in life. We could ask, though, so then if that's so essential, so why is it that God created nature? If that's going to mislead a person, so let's understand then what the role of nature is now. All right? Does everybody hear the question?
I do. Nature be simply the framework in which a human being is to operate?
Okay, so let's say we didn't have nature. What will we have?
Chaos.
You mean to say it's necessary just for an intelligent being to function?
Well, nature is a form of order. And I would submit that it would be almost impossible, maybe totally impossible, for a man to operate without order.
Right. You wouldn't know to go to a tree to get his fruit today, because maybe tomorrow the fruit is going to grow out of rock or something.
Right.
So you mean to say... That's a good point. So you need nature because that allows an intelligent being to have certain patterns to have survival.
Which, as an aside, also should be, for the discerning person, an indicator that there is a creator, because we don't see order happen by accident.
Right. That's two very fundamental ideas you're saying. Those are two very, very important ideas. So you're saying, number one, you need to have the framework in which a person can function. Otherwise, he just can't function without feeling a sense of consistency in the world. What are you going to do? I mean, maybe this worked now, but 2 seconds later, it's not going to work. I could assume I walk now, but 2 seconds later, there's no gravity. So in order to have a sense of a path, in order to function, it'll be impossible if everything was haphazard, if nothing was consistent. Agreed. So just mere existence is necessary. Simultaneously, you're saying also...
Rabbi, isn't it true that Hashem gave us nature to enjoy as another gift?
Yeah, that's also true. That's also true. just thinking out loud here. They never really tackled this question before. It's so fundamental. So if we have to look into, I mean, it's a way that the commands also are dependent upon nature.
How do you mean?
I mean that you can't have like a repetitive law of a lulav and esrog if this year a lulav grows and next year it doesn't. You can't have concept of putting mezuzah on your house if one year a person needs to have shelter and the next year he doesn't need it anymore because the laws of nature changed. So everything is dependent upon, you need to have that. But,
very good. I didn't think of it that way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What's the opposite of a Pandora's box? See, a Pandora's box is something you open it up. It's disturbing and chaotic, and it leads to trouble. We just opened the question, which I think is going to lead to amazing things, because we're asking on a very fundamental design.
I would postulate that the opposite of a Pandora's box is order that leads down to a single unity.
Right. I would say tip of an iceberg, but whenever you think of the iceberg, you think of the, was it with a ship that sunk?
Titanic.
That's a negative connotation, but tip of the iceberg often means that, you know, you're just scratching the surface of what's over here. If we could just think out loud. So to have the order, you're right also, the order portrays the wisdom. That was your second idea. It portrays It displays a designer of that order. So that's another thing. So there's more to it. We have to explore it. I wouldn't mind going, you know, spending time in that. But I think we're already on a tangent because we're not doing Kahelis, although this did bring us back to Kahelis a few chapters ahead of ourselves. But I think if we had to, you know, sum up what Maimonides is saying here, is that the primary rule, and again, why he places this in the laws of Shemitah and Yovel, is that you have to have laws in the Torah system that bring a person back, because the person will be misled by nature. And if he has to demonstrate his trust in God, and God shows out, don't worry, I'm running it. You may feel that, you know, you're just going to have the same amount of produce each year, but if you follow my system, I'll override it. And that's what you have even in the Torah. So God says in the last prophet, Malachi, chapter 3, verse 10, God says, test me in this area and see if I don't open up the storehouses of heaven, and I'll empty out for you a blessing more than enough. Meaning when you give your tithes and you give your charity. So then don't feel that this is going to minimize your income. By living properly and trusting in God and parting with your money is a demonstration that you believe that God can replace what you've just parted with, and he'll take care of it. So your concern shouldn't be there. The reason why a person is concerned is because he's too attached to what his mathematical mind tells him. He doesn't realize that God's running the mathematics, and he can, in his own ways, you lessen your money by giving it, God can make sure that you have. And he'll give you more, more than enough. As Rabbi Chait said, though, a person has to have a concept of enough. So a lot of people feel more than enough means, like, you know, something which never ends. But that's, you know, it's a foolish thing. It's an infantile thing. We're just having endless amounts of money. A person's living properly, like the Maimonides says over here, a person lives properly, God gives him sustenance that is sufficient for him. Doesn't say it makes him rich. He gives him all his needs, his clothing, his food, his shelter, all the needs that he needs. What more do you need after that? You're not staying here forever. So to pile up more and more is a foolish thing. There's only a certain amount of use. there's only a certain amount of needs that you have. The rest of the time, a person who's like this, he's pursuing knowledge. So it's a distraction. That's what the rabbis say. So that's why Maimonides places it here, because this is really what the whole lesson is about, understanding that God is running the universe. So when you can release your hands from working that seventh year, every seventh year, then you've made a demonstration that you really trust that God is running the universe. And that's what he puts in here, that if a person lives properly, it doesn't have to be every 7 years, but it's always. That's why at the very end, this happens all the time. Levi, the whole tribe of Levi, is not working ever, and God takes care of their needs. And any individual, man or woman, Jew, Gentile, that they live this way and they are really pursuing what God wants, and they abandon looking over the shoulder at what other people are saying, and they can be independent, and the only thing which is on their mind is truth, and they are not clouded by the calculations that King Solomon brings down over there in 729, the last verse in chapter 7. In Kohelet. A person, if he can remove himself from that, and that's not his concern, and then he's really living as God made him, because that's how he was at the outset, before he adopted all these foolish ideas as he grew up in a corrupt society. And that's why he terms him as one who is separate. Again, holy means separate. He's highly separated. I mean, this whole thing is talking about he separates himself. Right? I'll read it again. He's not only the tribe of Levi, but rather any man, any person, from anybody who enters the world, that his spirit moves him, and he understands from his own knowledge to separate. There's the first time he talks about it. Separate from who? He separates himself to stand before God, from others, and he to worship and to serve him, to know God. That's the objective. And he goes upright like God had made him. That's the second reference, meaning not as he became later on because of society, but as God made him pure, with the right path. And he separates from, and he removes, he breaks off from his neck the yoke of calculations of the many. There's the third reference to others. He's separating himself from, right? That the rest of mankind seeks out. So this person becomes highly separated, highly sanctified, all right? So there's the fourth reference. That is, he's separating himself from others. And God becomes his portion. There's a fifth reference. God's his portion as opposed to who? Others. He doesn't look to others. He doesn't look, he's not living in the social framework. He lives in a framework where it's God's conditions, God's considerations. That's exactly what King David did when Shimei ben Gera was cursing him. So King David's men said, should we silence him? Should we take care of him? David says, no. He says, let him be, because God had told him to do this. How can King David say that a person's free will is from God? That's a contradiction. Free will means that Shimei ben Gera, he was cursing David from his own sinful mind, his own sinful heart. But what David was saying, and I'm quoting Rabbi Mann on this, what King David was saying, he was expressing his attitude that, I know it's him doing it, he's a sinner, and he'll get punished for it. But when King David said that God told him to do it, King David was saying, in other words, my perspective is how this affects my relationship with God. Meaning, I'm looking at it as if it's something from God. Not that God willed this, but in my life, King David says, I look at everything in terms of the ultimate picture. Another good example is when Joseph said to his brothers that you didn't send me down to Mitzrayim, to Egypt. You didn't send me to Egypt. You didn't sell me. It was God's will that I come here and I provide sustenance for Egypt and for everybody. But how could Joseph say that? His brothers did sin. They did sell him. So how could Joseph say that God sent me down? It's a statement. And Maimonides talks about this in his Guide to the Perplexed. And he quotes this very case of King David. When these prophets and these high-level people said that God, it's God's will and or God did it, they're talking about that, yes, ultimately, you know, God created the universe. And everything that's taking place can't take place unless God allows it. He's not saying that God willed the brothers to sell him. What Joseph was saying to his brothers, he was trying to say, I don't live in this type of retaliatory, you know, social, psychological framework where I'm always involved in what people said, what he said, what she said. That's not what I care about. I care about that. I look at the fact is that my coming down here was for a good. I ended up being able to feed so many people. So that's all I care about. I'm not going to retaliate. They spoke to Joseph. They were afraid that he was going to take revenge for the sale. So he was trying to calm them and said, no, I don't work that way. Look what happened. This ended up to be a good thing. What you did, yes, you've got to work on yourselves. That's a sin. You did a sin. But that's what he meant when he said that God really put me down here. Meaning I'm looking at it in terms of, is there a good here in God's world? Not that God ordained these brothers to sell them. Right? If you just read the words, simply, yes, it sounds like that's what he's saying. But God doesn't cause a person to sin, though, to do mitzvahs. So it's important that we understand. I mean, it's a hard statement, but if we think about it, yes, we could see another understanding of what it means when Joseph said, you didn't sell me. It was God's plan or whatever. Right? So that's the framework. If a person lives in that framework, that means he's not living in a lifestyle where he's so caught up with what are people going to say if I do this or if I wear that or that. See, a person like Joseph and a person like King David were independent, and they followed what their minds told them, and they're always, God was always the consideration. That's what it means that God was their portion. That's how they valued things. That's how they evaluated things. And because of that, they're not going to be affected by the tides that take place. And God will make sure that they have their needs. Because that's why God put a person on earth, is to live that lifestyle. So if they are living that lifestyle, God will ensure that they have their needs taken care of. That's exactly what my mind is saying here. And that's why he ends off the law, and he says that God is my portion and my cup. You're my lot. Okay, let me pause here, see if there's any questions or comments.
So, Rabbi, a little earlier you said there are three different references to how this ideal person lives. Can we just summarize those real quickly?
Yeah, it ends up that I'm wrong. There are five.
Five, okay.
Okay. And they're all referring to the fact that he's not living based on others, but he is living based on himself. The
okay.
First one is, and I'll read it. I'll read it in English again one more time. Not the tribe of Levi alone, meaning not them alone, will God have providence over. But any person that enters the world, that his spirit moves him, and he understands from his knowledge to, number one, separate himself. There's the first one, to separate himself. What is he separating himself from? Others. That he stands before God to minister before him, to worship him, to know God. And he goes upright like God made him. Like God made him, meaning at his beginning and not at his end, meaning after he was made, 20, 30 years later when he adopted, and I'm suggesting this one here. This one's, I think, a stretch, but I believe that's what he's saying, that he goes upright as God made him, not as he becomes later on after he adopts corrupt social notions. That's what I call the second one. Then he goes on, another statement, and he breaks off from his neck the yoke of the calculations of the masses. Clearly, that's the third one, right? And he says that other people are always seeking, right? So that's all one statement. He breaks off from his neck the calculations. I mean, he removes from himself that type of lifestyle or all those different thoughts and wrong notions that people have. And calculations, literally, I mean, cheshbonos, the Hebrew word cheshbonos, or calculations, could mean literally, the simplest explanation is monetary calculations, worrying about this penny and that penny. Right? And then he says, this person becomes sanctified of sanctified, meaning separate. That's the fourth one. He's separate from what? He's separate from all others. When you sanctify an animal, you separate it for donation to the temple. So when a person is separate, that means he's separate from other people. So that's the fourth reference. And then here's the fifth reference is, and God will be his portion. Meaning that's that now he chooses God as opposed to what? Society. That's the fifth reference, that he's now deviating. But they're all different aspects of the deviation. That God is his portion forever, at all time. Right? Milolam, on the earth, ulaolme olmim, and for all eternity. Meaning, he guarantees himself a place in the world to come. And he merits in this world a sufficient lot. Just like the priests and the Levites merit. But you see,
thank you.
Right, so you see that. It's just, you know, I'll have to tell the guys what we were learning yesterday, just how this it just breaks down more and more. But and that's what he says, David's claim is. The last line here, he says, David, peace be upon him, said, God is my portion and my cup. You know, like a cup of salvation, or a person raises up his cup of wine when he wants to show how important something is. That's why when we do certain things in Judaism, so it's done over a cup of wine, because wine is a very important type of substance that has a different type of effect on man than other foods. Other foods just fill you. Wine not only gives you a feel of satiation, but it gives you an ease, and it gives you the ability to be happy. So you raise up something important when you want to underline how important your statement is going to be. That's the concept of a toast. But again, I think it's very important too that we realize how Maimonides couched this law, this philosophy, in the laws of the Shemitah and the Yovel, because that's what, you know, Shemitah and Yovel is all about. It's all about a demonstration of a release of a person's own attachment to how nature works, and realizes, testifies to trust in God, and that God is really behind it all. You see that the very first law of Shemitah and Yovel, so he says that it's a positive command to rest from working the land and working trees. In the seventh year, as it says, you should rest the land, a rest to God. Now we understand what it means, a rest to God. It's a rest in terms of for us to recognize God again, to that sense of trust in nature that can obscure the concept that God will step in, and the whole concept of God's providence. So we rest and we recognize God as being the one that's really running everything. And if we have that conviction, if we have the conviction, so then a person will have that trust and he'll apply it to himself daily. Because that trust in God should not be limited to only once every 7 years. It should just be like the Levites, which is every day. And if a person wants, that's what Maimonides is summing this up and telling you, that although on a national level it's only once every 7 years, on an individual level you see it with the Levites, and on a personal level we can apply it to ourselves. That's one of the most primary lessons. Okay, I'll stop here. See if there's any questions or comments.
Good here. Thank you.
Okay. What, is Rabbi Moskowitz picked up his class again, or no? Is he still out of commission?
He hadn't picked it up. I was going to call him here soon and kind of find out where he is. I think he's still in recovery.
Okay. All right. Naomi, you're welcome. Naomi is just writing down that she's able to hear properly. Okay. All right, so maybe we'll pursue this thing about nature a little bit more. Again, next week, of course, is Rosh Hashanah, so there won't be
I'll be class. So we'll pick up in 2 weeks. But again, if there's any questions, you know, feel free to email during the week.
Okay.
Okay, then.
Thank you, Rabbi. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks, Rabbi.
Okay, have a great week and a great holiday.
Good week, everybody. Everybody happy and a healthy New Year.
Yeah, happy New Year to everybody. Remember, you know, New Year is for the whole world. It's not just for the Jews. So we shall keep that in mind. It's, you know, a cold boy, everybody who comes to the world.
Mm-hmm. And happy New Year to you and all on the call.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Be well, all the families, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.